Oh yeah, it's a box of 12. Great. So as the last non-panel discussion speaker of the conference, I thought I would address the question, why are we here? And as you might guess, this question is being asked in two senses. One is, why are we at this conference? What is our purpose here? And our purpose here, in some sense, is to ask the other sense of the question, why are we here in this universe? Why does our universe look the way it does? Now, you might suspect that this is, therefore, a talk that would have been more appropriate at the beginning of the conference than at the end of the conference. But I can assure you that I am an expert on the arrow of time, and it makes no difference whatsoever when the talk actually appears. Actually, that's not true. One of my goals as I wrote the talk was to try to incorporate the ideas that were actually talked about in the conference, and in some sense to put them together to make a cosmological model. We'll see if something like that is possible. So why does our universe look the way it does? Well, I want to address this as sort of robustly as possible, making as few unrealistic assumptions as possible. So let's start with ourselves here today. Here we are living at some point in the universe at a time after the Big Bang, T1, I'm calling it, 13.7 billion years after the Big Bang. And I want to draw the causal patch that is defined by me, or like to be more specific, I could pick a proton in my body and I could trace it backward. And I want to trace it backward not to the Big Bang, but to a time 1 second after the Big Bang. So this is T0 is 1 second. And I want to construct the causal patch that I get by taking the best past light cone from me today and the future light cone of that point in my past and letting them intersect. And so let me explain why I'm doing this. I'm picking 1 second because that is the earliest time in the history of the universe for which we have data. We have knowledge from Big Bang nucleosynthesis of what the universe was like 1 second after the Big Bang. So I want to look at a part of the history of the universe where we think we understand the physics very well, and just see what statements we can make just about that, how sensible it is or not sensible it is. And the reason why I'm looking at a causal patch is not because I have any deep, profound notions of complementarity or holography that I am interested in, although that would be nice, but just because a patch like this has the property that if I use my freedom of diffeomorphism invariance to slice it, to foliate it into space-like slices, then the domain of dependence of any one slice is the whole diamond. So forgetting about quantum gravity or anything like that, just in classical physics or in sort of semi-classical quantum physics on this background, if I know the microstate of the universe, gamma of t is the microstate, the specific state that the universe is in, on any one of those slices, I should be able to predict it, both the past and future, on any other slice in that diamond. So this is a well-defined autonomous system that evolves, and we want to ask, why is it like that? Why is that the system that we find ourselves in? So in particular, the interesting slices here are today. So the state of the universe on our past light cone, gamma 1, and the initial conditions, the state of the universe on the past boundary here, gamma 0. And there are two questions we can ask about this. So this is all known physics. We're trying to figure out why the universe is like that. I should also parenthetically say this is a bizarre question to care about as far as science is concerned. It's at least, if it's not bizarre, it's at least unique. There is nothing that we know about what happens to the universe within this diamond that is in any way problematic as far as the laws of physics are concerned. We think we know the rules. Now that we understand that there's something called dark matter and dark energy, there's no observation that happens in there that does not fit the known laws of physics. So we're not trying to construct a theory that fits the data any better. We have some data, and we're trying to understand why is it that data rather than some other data. So strictly speaking, you're always allowed to not be interested in this question. You're always allowed to say, that's what the universe is. I observed it to be that way, and I'm done. I can't prevent you from taking that attitude. But there's a selection effect that you probably wouldn't be in this room if you were taking that attitude. So we're going to try to be more ambitious and say why this particular data, even though it's perfectly consistent with our laws of physics. But the reason why it's worth emphasizing that is because the whole criterion for success or failure of your grand cosmological model will be whether it explains why we find ourselves in that kind of causal patch. Should I not call it a causal patch? Is that okay? Should I just call it a diamond? Is it okay to call it a causal patch even though it's not an extendable line? I want to get the words right. I blame you two, so I'm asking you, yes. All right, I'll call it a causal patch. It's not inextendable, the particular geodesic that I used to define it. And so I like to think about this problem in terms of entropy. So these states, little gamma, that evolve from time zero to time one, are evolving in some space, capital gamma, which is the space of all the little gammas. And in this space of states, we have certain macroscopic information. We observe where galaxies are, where the photons are. We do not have full microscopic information. We do not know the wave function or even the classical position and momentum of each individual particle in the universe. So we partition the space of states into regions of identical macroscopic information. So we say that here was gamma zero. It belongs to a set capital gamma zero. Here is little gamma one. It belongs to a set capital gamma one. And out here, you have capital gamma equilibrium, the largest entropy configuration you could find of this collection of degrees of freedom. And the entropy, maybe you already agree with this, but some people don't agree with this, so I'm going to say it anyway. I'm thinking of entropy as something objective. I'm not thinking of the entropy as reflecting our knowledge of the system. I'm saying that there is something called the macroscopically accessible information of the system. And that is not random, right? When we take the air in this room, there is microscopic information that is the position and momentum of every molecule, and we coarse grain it. But we don't coarse grain it in an arbitrary way. We take, you know, a little cubic centimeter or something of air, and we average, so we know the number of particles, we know the velocity of those particles, et cetera. So we localize in position space. We could coarse grain by localizing in momentum space, but that's ridiculous. It would be useless to do that. And the reason why is because the Hamiltonian of the world gives us accessible information if we localize in position space, but wouldn't if we localized in momentum space. So the coarse graining we do to go from the microstates to the macrostates is not arbitrary. It might not be absolutely well-defined. There could be some wiggle room in there, but it's basically given to us by the Hamiltonian of the world. And once that is true, entropy is a characteristic of microstates. If you have some microstate gamma that is inside some macrostate gamma, capital gamma, that is defined by, it's the equivalence class of all macroscopic observables, then its entropy is just the logarithm of the volume of capital gamma. Okay, so that's all stuff we all agree with and is true. So there are two kinds of questions we can ask about this causal patch. Two kinds of why are we here questions. Question number one is, why gamma one? Why do we find ourselves in our current condition of the universe? Why do we live in a universe that has 100 billion galaxies, homogeneous and isotropic, et cetera? So we could quantify this a little bit in terms of this entropy idea by saying that we calculate the entropy of the universe today within this causal patch. And because of the hugeness and ridiculousness of the numbers, the details of the numbers don't matter. The important point is that S of gamma 1, the entropy of our universe now, or roughly now, is much, much less than, let's say, any possible anthropic criterion you might want to put on it. You don't need 100 billion galaxies arranged uniformly throughout the universe in order to have people. The anthropic criterion that you might want to invent is also much less than the equilibrium entropy. And if you plug in numbers, roughly speaking, if you think of the number of states as being interpretable as a probability, I'm not saying that you should, but if you did that, then the probability of finding yourself in a state like capital gamma 1, in a state that is the coarse grain state that we live in today, is something like 10 to the minus 10 to the 120, as Penrose pointed out a long time ago. So it's very unlikely. So I'm going to take the attitude in this. I've been growing into this attitude over the years, and this conference made it worse, that this is not the right question to ask. That we shouldn't worry too much about this question, because it's very a posteriori. It's like, you know, seeing some particular license plate and going, wow, how unlikely it was that I saw exactly those numbers on the license plate. In particular, I have become convinced that it doesn't make sense to pretend that we are typical observers in the universe. This is a typical way of motivating this question by saying that typical observers in the universe would see very, very different conditions. They would not see a small cosmological constant, or they would, or whatever, and trying to justify what we see by saying that's what typical observers see. I don't think that's the right thing to do. This is the lesson that I took from Jim Hartle's paper with Mark Shrednicki. One way of saying it is that the supposition that we are typical observers in the universe sounds very humble, right? It's essentially what Alex Blanken refers to as the principle of mediocrity. We're just ordinary old people in the universe. There's nothing special about us. How more humble could you get? Yes. Yes. Oh, no. What I meant by yes was no, yes. What I mean, I'm saying that what we should not do is to assume that we are typical observers in some grand ensemble and use that to calculate the probability that we'd find ourselves in state gamma 1. Well, so I think we're allowed to do it in what, behind the veil of ignorance. What John Rawls called the initial position, the original position, sorry. If you don't know who you are in the universe, and you are likely to say, well, how would I like to arrange the universe to make it comfortable for whoever I will end up being, then it's perfectly okay to assume that you will be a typical observer. So if you haven't yet flipped the coin, you're completely welcome to say, I'm going to get a typical result. That's fine. But in fact, by saying, but we know who we are, right? We know who we are, and therefore, if you say, I'm going to assume we are typical observers in the universe, you're not being humble at all, because you already know who you are. That assumption is tantamount to saying that typical observers are like me. It is the maximally anthropocentric assumption you could possibly make to say that we are typical observers in the universe. One way of saying it is, I can certainly imagine, my ignorance about the laws of biology and chemistry and physics are substantial enough that I could imagine that we are typical observers in the universe. That most observers in the whole history of the universe are carbon-based life forms living in wet environments on terrestrial planets. That's possible. Maybe even life on Earth is the only life in the universe. That's possible. In which case, a typical observer lives 10 to the 10 years after the Big Bang. It is also possible, I think, that there is life on neutron stars. Robert Forward wrote a great science fiction novel called Dragon's Egg about little microscopic beings that live on neutron stars. And I can imagine that this is completely possible. A typical neutron star has, you know, trillions of little intelligent conscious beings on it. And the typical observer in the universe lives 10 to the 20 years after the Big Bang. I could imagine that there can be very low metabolism plasma beings that live in the atmosphere of evaporating black holes, and that most of them live 10 to the 90 years after the Big Bang. I can imagine all of these things. What I'm saying is that I really hope that my theory of cosmology doesn't care which one of those is true. I suspect it's the case that if I pretend to be developing a fundamental theory of physics or cosmology, and the predictions my theory makes depend sensitively on the definition of the phrase conscious observer, then I've gone terribly, terribly wrong. That's, I know not everyone agrees, but this is my current belief. So, I'm not sure if I should take questions from people sitting in the very last row of this. There you go. All right, you've upgraded. I don't think that's the theory we should be developing. No, that's what I'm suggesting. We can argue about it, but you know, let me put it this way: it's extremely therapeutic to stop asking these questions. When you start asking what should typical observers see, and you run into all these crazy answers, you go, wow, this is really bad. And then you go, well, maybe I shouldn't ask those questions. It's very liberating. Like, ah, it all makes sense now. So it doesn't it doesn't mean that the measure problem is not a crucial problem. So the second question we could be asking is, given gamma 1, why gamma 0? Given that we ended up here at the end of the future boundary of our causal diamond, why did we start in the state that we started in? This is a conditional question. This has no mention of conscious life, intelligent observers, typicality, or anything like that. It's saying we have data, we have all the data, so it's, I think this is at least compatible with Radford Neil's talk. I don't want to blame him for the attitude, but it's compatible with fully non-indexical conditioning. We take everything that we know, and we ask, given that, what else should we expect? Given that we find ourselves with our data today, what have we should have expected for the past? Now, purely physics-based reasoning does not let you say, from the data we have now, that the data on gamma zero was what we actually think it was. Given that we live in a universe with 100 billion galaxies, large-scale perturbations at the order of 10 to the minus 5, things like that, given that we have impressions in our brains that there's something called the cosmic microwave background with small fluctuations, just that data does not mean that we started in the early conditions that we think we started in. We think we started in low entropy conditions at early times, approximately homogeneous and isotropic, etc. But in fact, if you just count trajectories through this state space, the overwhelming majority of trajectories that are compatible with gamma 1 did not start with smaller fluctuations at gamma 0 and have them grow, did not start with low entropy at gamma 0 and have it grow. They started with higher entropy. This is a space of states in this causal patch, and you can count them, and you can go backwards. And the entropy in gamma 0 is much smaller than the entropy in gamma 1. So if you count trajectories, the overwhelming majority of trajectories that pass through gamma 1 never pass through gamma 0. So why is S gamma 0 much, much less than S gamma 1? If you plug in the numbers analogously, the probability of finding yourself in gamma 1, sorry, the probability that you started in gamma 1 given that you ended in gamma, sorry, my notes do not match what I'm trying to say out loud. The probability you started in gamma 0, given that you ended in gamma 1, is something like 10 to the minus 10 to the 100. So it is also a really big...
Are these capital gammas?
They sound
like they're sphere rather than
micro. Yeah, sorry. Capital gammas. I got it right there. Yes. No, here, okay. That's fair. I would erase it, but I'm getting all chalky, so I won't. But yes, it should be capital gammas in this line and this line. This question, I think, is perfectly well defined. There's no mention of conscious observers, blah, blah, blah. There is clearly a measure problem. You need to know what the measure is if you're gonna answer this problem. So, what you want, I claim, if you claim that you have a theory of the multiverse or the universe or cosmology, a comprehensive theory of cosmology, what you're asking for from that theory is F of gamma 0, gamma 1, sorry, capital gamma 0, capital gamma 1, the fraction of trajectories realized in the universe passing through gamma 1 that started in gamma 0. So the crucial word here is realized in the universe. So if you just do state counting, the fraction is this, this incredibly tiny number. So this is related to Neil's talk, Neil Turok's talk at the beginning of the conference. You have, if you just make the approximation that things are approximately classical in this late time, you have a measure. You know what the measure is on the space of trajectories. Is that a question or just a yawn, or both? Yeah, no, but by a measure problem, I just mean you need a measure. I don't mean it's very difficult to get one. Let me keep going, and my assumption will become more clear. I think there's different subsets of assumptions that you could make. Yes? Yeah. Yes. I would say, given the data that we have now in the big old universe, what do I predict the cosmological constant would be? I believe that it's okay to both take our data here on gamma 1 and agree that we came from a thermodynamically sensible universe that started in gamma 0. And I would ask, given that knowledge in this ensemble, what do I predict for the cosmological constant? No. It's all because it's a conditional question. It's saying, given that I'm surrounded by 100 billion galaxies, what should the cosmological constant be? That is not why am I surrounded by 100 billion galaxies. That's the difference. Am I fixing the boundary of the initial conditions? I'm fixing neither one of those. I'm just saying that clearly let me finish my thought about Neil's talk, and maybe it will become a little bit more clear. One thing that you can try to ask is something like, how likely is inflation? You don't need to ask that, but people have asked that. And they argue whether or not, you know, in the universe that we live in today, it's at late times. Imagine there's some scalar field that is homogeneous. You wind it backwards. You un-evolve the universe, and you ask, what is the probability to pass through some inflationary phase? I think that that's not a hard question. That's a really, really easy question. The probability of inflation is negligible, given what we know about the universe today, because the overwhelming majority of the trajectories compatible with the universe we know today become more and more inhomogeneous as you go backward in time. And Haywood Tam and I wrote a paper just to do the math, but you don't have to do the math. It's just obvious. The overwhelming majority of the universe of trajectories compatible with our current data were not in any way smooth at early times, which they would have been had they passed through inflation. So that is not to say that inflation is unlikely. It's just to say that trajectories passing through gamma 1, the overwhelming majority of them did not have an inflationary past. But we know that we don't live in a universe which is typical in gamma 1, so we need to do better than that. So that's not the right question to ask. So I'm suggesting that if you're interested in question 2, you need to have a theory of the whole universe, and you need to be able to ask this conditional question. So there are different possibilities. So here's where we get to being careful about what the assumptions are. One possibility is that, as a simple fact about the dynamics, most I'm going to actually, so I'm about to contradict things I've already said, and then I will explain the conditions under which that contradiction can be resolved. One possibility is that most trajectories in this phase space through gamma 1 pass through gamma 0. Now, I just said that's not true, so how am I allowed to contemplate that it is true? It is not true. This possibility is certainly false if I can believe the laws of physics that I think are true in this causal patch. So if it's the standard model plus perturbative general relativity, this statement is certainly false. Nevertheless, we could be hopeful. We could be optimistic. We could say maybe there is some subtle infrared magic, which sounds a little deprecatory, but I don't mean it to be. Maybe we just don't understand physics at these scales, you know, at ordinary everyday scales that we use for the late universe. This is essentially what Andy Albrecht's model suggests, that there's a whole bunch of states that you don't know about that correspond to trajectories that, in fact, do go from gamma 1 through gamma 0. So that, in fact, just as a matter of state counting, you could make this seem a lot more probable. Is that fair? I'm not especially fond of that, but I'm very fond of the fact that Andy pointed it out, because a year ago I would have said this is just impossible. And now I know there's a loophole. We need to do better than that. We need to think hard about this possibility. So if my measure is the number of people in this room who think this is a very plausible idea, is a 1 or 2% chance that it's right. It's definitely worth considering, though. But it certainly requires changing physics at accessible energies. Maybe not experimentally. Maybe we couldn't notice. They'd be very, very subtle, but it would definitely be a change. Another possibility is that evolving through gamma zero is anthropically selected. Maybe in order for life to arise, given conditions like gamma 1, you had to start in a low entropy past. This is just false. I'm writing it here for completeness, but it's just not true, because life exists in gamma 1 already. So the question is, given that life exists, that's part of the macro state that defines gamma 1. So there's no need for for life to exist does not demand that we ever pass through a lower entropy past. So don't. This is why I like this problem. This is why I like problem number 2, because you can't possibly be the anthropic principle all by itself that solves it. You need to think a little bit harder than that. So the third possibility is that the actual world, the multiverse, the universe, or whatever, happens to sample gamma 1 non-uniformly. So the way that we get into all of these problems is by saying that given our data that we are in capital gamma 1, we don't know anything else, so we use the principle of indifference. We just assume that we're in one of those states with equal probability. That's when we say that the chances that we were ever in gamma 0 are infinitesimally small. So that would be true in a universe with a finite space of states that lasted forever. Then you could use the ergodic theorem and show that that would actually be correct. Therefore, we do not live in a universe with a finite space of states that lasts forever. We live in something else. And this possibility is the actual world does not sample that space uniformly. It picks out certain trajectories. When you go through gamma 1, it's highly correlated with going through gamma 0 for some reason. It could be either once or it could be many times. It could be that there is just a history of the world. Once and for all, we did go through gamma 0 and we did go through gamma 1. Or it could be that there's a large universe and we went through many times, and most of the times it had this property. So these are called Sagan universes. Carl Sagan didn't call them that, but I called them that because there's a quote from Carl Sagan that says, "In order to make an apple pie, you must first invent the universe." His thought was that an apple pie seems pretty benign, but to make it, you needed apples, and therefore you needed an apple orchard, and therefore you needed a biosphere, and you needed flour, and you needed an oven, and all of those things. So that is false. in a universe with a finite phase space that lasts forever. In that universe, the overwhelming majority of apple pies are Boltzmann apple pies that fluctuate out of existence, and you do not need an apple orchard to make an apple pie. So the demand that the actual world is not like that is what you want. So in equations, this is the demand that if you find yourself in a condition where the entropy at time t plus delta t is much greater than the entropy at time t, then it is overwhelmingly probable that the entropy at time t minus delta t was less than the entropy at time t. Again, not true in an equilibrium ensemble, but we want this to be true of the universe. That's what we're looking for. All right, so how can we get there? That's right. So I've moved on from possibility number one. I've let go of that possibility, yes. Noted it, moved on. Yeah, sorry. But good of you to keep me honest. This is actually work. We're not at altitude, so I can't blame myself getting out of breath for erasing the blackboard. So this is what we want to do. We want to take this picture, this causal patch, and we want to fit it into a bigger picture. And we want to say that when examples of gamma 1 appear, they are correlated with examples of gamma 0. That is what we want out of our multiverse. So here's what people typically do. Eternal inflation, something like eternal inflation, they will draw a picture that looks like this. De Sitter, and I'm going to just imagine, just to make my life simpler, and we can expand the discussion later if you want, but I'm going to imagine that we have a landscape where there are various vacua of positive vacuum energy, and there is at least one vacuum of zero vacuum energy. There's at least one Minkowski vacuum. I'm not going to worry about the negative cosmological constant vacua. So what would happen is you start in De Sitter, you inflate quasi-De Sitter anyway, and occasionally you bubble off into bubbles of either other De Sitter or Minkowski or whatever. And if it's Minkowski, you eventually will end up in Minkowski if there's some probability of getting there, and then you don't leave once you're there. So you have some fractal future boundary condition. And, you know, we live here. No, we don't. This is Minkowski. We live here. We live somewhere. I drew the picture too small to make it clear. But the question is, can we fit this causal diamond into there, and can we have this correlation that we're looking for? Now, the real problem with this, well, there's a couple problems with this. My biggest problem with this is that it doesn't have a bottom. That it assumes something that we start in De Sitter space and then we go towards the future. But all the underlying laws of physics, almost everyone assumes, are reversible. You should be able to ask what happened in the past. And maybe you say that what happened in the past is you just had a singularity or some boundary condition. That's perfectly okay. All I'm saying is that you have to say something. And the most natural, so the point is that there is an asymptotic future that people always draw on their pictures. And I was going to say that no one in the whole conference drew a picture with both an asymptotic future and an asymptotic past, but then Don Page did it in the talk just before mine. Sorry. Yeah, I know, you really ruined the chance I had to make a real important point here. But so my suggestion is that you should not accept these half-asymptotic solutions, or if you just want to call them half-ass for short, cosmologies. You need to tell me what happens in the other direction. So, yeah, let me draw this bigger because it's gonna annoy me a little bit. Well, I'll just draw it bigger down here. So the first people I know who drew it better were Anthony Aguirre and Stephen Grattan. And they put a boundary condition actually on a null surface in De Sitter space. I'm not sure, is it crucial? Could I have just put the boundary condition? Where'd Anthony go? I could have just put it space-like, but they investigated for technical reasons because they were trying to poke Guth and Bourdain Vilenkin, they put it on a null surface, and so they have a surface solution looks like this, and more little terminal Minkowski vacua down there. So I like this picture better because it's at least it is honest about the past and the future. It doesn't answer the fine-tuning questions in any more direct way, but it brings more to the fore what you really would require to answer these fine-tuning questions. So how am I doing on time? 10 minutes? 15 minutes. So the worry that I have, the concern I have about a solution like this, is that this initial de Sitter space is very, very low entropy, if this is inflation, right? Yes, if you start in a de Sitter space with a false vacuum, very, very high energy, I do believe the story that you get in the future, you decay, you make the universe homogeneous and isotropic. But you're begging the question, I think, by starting in this de Sitter space. You need to tell me why we started in that very, very low entropy state. So in 2004, with Jennifer Chen, I wrote a paper where we imagined, so let me call this high de Sitter space, high energy density, high cosmological constant. So I wrote a paper with Jennifer where we imagined, what if you started in low de Sitter space? So what if our vacuum that we seem to live in right now, that has a cosmological constant of order 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth, is at least pretty darn stable, not necessarily completely stable, but the volume continues to grow in the usual eternal inflation way. So a greater and greater, we were not at all thinking locally or causal patchy, we were just thinking globally. What happens if you begin in this state? Because after all, that's a much higher entropy state. If you're going to begin somewhere, this seems like a more natural beginning state. And we said, well, maybe there could be baby universes. Maybe we could invoke the Guth-Fahey process, as Andy does in his model. And then I can't quite draw it on this Penrose diagram, but there could be like a little event that branched off and made a little de Sitter space that started very, very small because it was a baby universe, but then it expanded and cooled and it inflated and the whole story. And this, of course, would happen an infinite number of times. And there could be, you know, granddaughter universes and so forth. And it would happen backwards. So it would happen toward the past. So if you set your boundary conditions, if you said, I know what the state is at some space-like surface, and that state is pure de Sitter space, or whatever quantum state corresponds to that, I could evolve it toward the future and evolve it toward the past. And I would get the same exact story, just played backwards in time. So I would once again get a symmetric multiverse ensemble. So it depends on where you end up in the landscape when you tunnel. So you get everything that you could possibly get. That's right. So the hope, there's two hopes in this scenario. One hope is that I didn't need to fine-tune my initial conditions, as long as they were not in Minkowski space. If they were just in Minkowski space, you would just stay there. But at least this seems a lot less finely tuned quantitatively than starting here. The other hope was that it is easier, that you solve the measure problem by saying it's easier to make a baby universe than it is to make a Boltzmann brain, or to certainly make a Boltzmann universe. The fact that the baby universes are literally small, you could at least hope that you make more of them. And for every one you make, you get billions of observers in the final state, and you get universes that look like this, so you could try to address this problem. Yeah. Well, you need to set the initial state here. You do. That's right. I'm not fixing them. I'm claiming that I solve Schrodinger's equation, starting from these initial conditions. And so I'm going to claim that the universes that survive start small and ready to inflate. Those that aren't ready to inflate, well, they just collapse. And there are bigger ones, but they're more rare. So my hope is that it's all dynamical, that there's no resetting of initial conditions, that these are the only initial conditions. Obviously, a lot of this is moonshine, and I was going to be very clear that my interest in this model has declined every year, mostly because my friends keep telling me that you don't make baby universes and they don't disconnect from the background to sitter space. And they're still my friends, so I'm losing confidence that this model is true. But I like it. I like it in principle, just like Andy's model in principle. I don't believe that either, but it demonstrates an underlying hope. In this case, the underlying hope is more or less what Alan was trying to prove with his example of the infinitely big phase space. That you could start, if you start somewhere normalizable, and you're in an infinitely big space, then you can at least hope that the dynamics gets you to where you want to go. There's certainly still measure problems and also dynamical problems, but at least it's a hope. Yes? What do you mean by the conventional way of making baby universes? Right, okay, so that's also good. We were not thinking about then, or we thought about it, but then we thought that was annoying, so we didn't think about it too much. But that was, in fact, the next diagram on my piece of paper here. I'm not even going to draw it, because I'm running out of time, and I can just say it in words. If you don't allow for disconnected pieces of space-time in your Hilbert space, then I think, and this might not be true, but I think that the argument that you get a lot more Boltzmann universes than ordinary universes is a lot easier to make. In other words, it seems easier in this case than in the case where I just stay in de Sitter space and I up-tunnel in the process that Anthony was talking about, for me to argue that universes that patches that end in gamma 1 will start in gamma 0. I mean, Anthony explained to us a way you can make a whole universe just by thermal fluctuations in de Sitter. It would start like things randomly coming in from very far away. And the whole process is unlikely. But even worse, it is a concatenation of a series of individually very unlikely events that involves photons coming in from infinity, galaxies and black holes unforming, omelets turning into eggs, etc. That is all very unlikely, and yet the most likely way of up-tunneling and making a new universe. And so you could do that, and then you could have a little universe in here, and maybe it could have new de Sitter vacua, and you could start eternal inflation that way. It just seemed harder for me to justify the counting that I wanted to do, but that might be wrong. So I don't know how to do it in either case. So anyone who wants to argue this is perfectly good, I'm in favor of it. Yes, that's right. That's fine. Okay, then I'm very willing to believe that. That would be great. Happy to go with that. I was just skeptical back in 7 years ago or whatever. Okay, so what do I think should be the right answer? I have 5 minutes.
Yes.
What might work? So I'm going to take inspiration. I don't want to blame them. Is Raphael here? Is Lenny here? They're both gone. So I'm blaming them. So Raphael and Lenny wrote this very interesting paper, and there was another one by Yoshinori Nomura that said similar things. And what I take from their papers are two things. Number one, that we should think locally. We should always live within our causal patch and describe what happens in our causal patch. Obviously, that is not, they're not the first ones to say that, but they said it in a way that I get. and what else? Well, that's good enough. Okay. So if that's true, then what would I count as a reasonable cosmology if I ignore the possibility of actually branching to disconnected pieces and if I stay in my same connected piece of space? So let me have my mini landscape with three vacuum states, 1, 2, 3. And so I have a terminal vacuum, vacuum 3, which is Minkowski space. And what I take from these ideas is that if I have a world line that ends in some terminal vacuum, and I trace it back to some terminal vacuum in the past, and I draw its causal diamond, then in some sense, I can just ignore the rest of the universe. I'm not going to be strict about what that sense is. But since I'm only paying attention to what can be observed by one world line, this is the part of the universe that I care about. And this history might involve all sorts of jumps between different vacua in the landscape, but this is the question I want to ask. Starting in this Minkowski terminal vacuum and ending in this Minkowski terminal vacuum, what am I likely to experience along that infinitely long world line? I think that's, if you buy into this philosophy, that is the question that you should be asking as a multiversal cosmologist. So given that philosophy and given this background, I'm going to draw three cosmologies that I think fit all of the criteria. One is you start in Minkowski space. You start in Minkowski space. Clearly, that's the bottom of the board. Okay? And in this cosmology, you stay in Minkowski space. So you never leave. But when I say Minkowski space, I mean that's the vacuum state. You're a perturbation of that vacuum state. So it's not pure Minkowski space. There's stuff in this universe. And the stuff comes in from scry minus, and it makes a little person or people, depending on how optimistic you are, and then you dissolve back to scry plus. This is what Raphael and Lenny called the S-matrix cosmology, and they didn't like it because it didn't help them solve the wave function collapse problem in quantum mechanics. But I think from a cosmology point of view, this is perfectly legit. This is one of the things that could happen. And if you think that everything can happen, then this is a branch of your wave function with some amplitude, and your job is to tell me what it is. Another possibility is that I start in Minkowski space, and there is a perturbation of Minkowski space that includes just the right fluctuations to come in and uptunnel. So I bounce into, so this is vacuum one, sorry, three, and I stay in three the whole way. Here's vacuum three, and I uptunnel to vacuum two. So now I'm into sitter space, and I'm there for a while, and eventually I tunnel back to vacuum three again. But all I care about is this causal diamond here, what's inside. And vacuum two is low energy density. It's 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. It's not inflation, really. It's like our current universe. So this is, it seems harder to set this up, because you need to have enough stuff coming in to make a whole universe. I think, you know, remember the point of Anthony's talk was that if you imagine here, you're in this vacuum, you decay via tunneling, you enter the Minkowski terminal vacuum, you reheat, you scatter light degrees of freedom all over the universe. The most likely way to get to vacuum two is to start in the time reverse of that. So you have a whole bunch of light degrees of freedom come in and push you up the potential, push you over, and you end up in vacuum two, and then you fluctuate around because you're in a quasi-thermal state, and you end up in vacuum three. And finally, well, you can guess what's going to come next. I start in vacuum three. I tunnel up. I end up into sitter space. But then I tunnel up again. So somewhere in here, sorry, two, somewhere in here, if I drew the stretched horizon, so I look at sort of one Planck unit away from the actual light cone, somewhere I tunnel up again into vacuum number one, and then I go back to vacuum number two again, I relax back. So I think that all of these are perfectly good cosmologies in the sense that they're not half-assed. They have a future and a past. They are compatible with this theory of everything that I just wrote down, that there's a terminal vacuum and a couple of de Sitter vacua. And what we want to do is calculate where we likely live. And so I don't know the answer. Happily, I'm out of time, so I can't give you the answer because I don't know it. But what I want to be true, there's two questions I could ask, question number one and question number two. My problem is that if I'm just asking question number one, if I'm just a person, then I can't see why things like this wouldn't dominate everything. It's just much easier to make a person in some, not as a thermal fluctuation, but just as some amplitude in the wave function. It still seems easier than to make a whole universe. But maybe, And the same thing would be true in 2 compared to 1. It's just easier to fluctuate a person in here than to fluctuate into a higher energy density vacuum. Maybe the answer is that in the wave function of the universe, when you combine the amplitude for universes like this with the demand that they pass through states that look like gamma 1, you will find that they usually pass through states like gamma 0. I don't know if that's true, but I think that's a good hope to have. And it's always good to have hope at the end of a conference like this. Thank you.
Okay, questions for Sean. Can we get back there, Latham?
Hi. I very like your first like diamond shaped picture. And that gave a very well-defined question, and I'm very puzzled by why do we kind of fascinated by this idea of evolving things backward. I can appreciate that more in the context that Neil's talk. But in your question, you said it that very precisely, right? You have gamma 1 at 13.6 gigayears, and something, gamma 0 at 1 second. You ask, given gamma 1, what is most likely gamma 2? And there's a standard way to answer that without doesn't involve evolving anything backward. You pick several possible gamma zero, evolve them forward, and pick those gamma zero that's most likely to end up in gamma one, and you say that's the best gamma zero. And what's wrong with that logic?
It's just asking a very, very different question. Every gamma zero ends up in gamma one to a good approximation. That's the second law of thermodynamics. But the overwhelming majority of trajectories that get to gamma 1 were never in gamma 0. We believe that the actual universe was in gamma 0, therefore there is something to be explained.
There's a similar question to this in a generator example. Do you agree?
In the what case?
In a generator example, in a box.
Box of gas.
Gas. Let's say gamma 1 is you see the gas are in half of the box, and I ask, okay, 1 second earlier, because in this definition, you give a very precise what time earlier you want to ask. In 1 second earlier, is it more likely that my air molecules are occupying a volume smaller than half or bigger than half? I can give you a very definite answer, which is smaller.
There is a problem there because that's a very different question when you apply it to the universe than when you apply it to a box of gas. An unbroken egg is a low entropy state, and yet when I open my refrigerator and see an unbroken egg, I do not go, oh my God, how unlikely was that? There's an unbroken egg in my refrigerator. Because the egg is not a closed system. It's part of a much larger system that started in even lower entropy. We're far, far, far out of equilibrium. But that begs the question that we're interested in here. Within your question was not contained the assumption that we were in a much larger out-of-equilibrium system. If it were, then that would be trying to address these questions. But this causal patch is an autonomous system all by itself. And if you just count trajectories in phase space, most of them don't go through gamma zero. Therefore, you shouldn't just count trajectories through phase space. But the question is, what should you do? And that's what I'm trying to answer.
Okay.
Hi, Sean. So I'm assuming that ultimately you'd like to address the time zero by asking this question, why did you start with gamma zero? So the two points that I'm confused are, first of all, having all these bubbles pop, as in eternal inflation or by tunneling, you are ultimately driving the entropy of the sitter state, breaking the Gibbons-Hawking bound and driving it to infinity. And that seems to lead to perpetuum mobile. You are mining energy out of the background, the sitter. And I think the reason for that
Are you referring to this?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because you are making the entropy of that thing infinite from being finite. So that there is a perpetuum mobile. And I think the reason is related to the fact that every time you see that some vacua, you are not really getting a cosmology like our universe. You need to do something more to that, to throw a few more assumptions, because you'll get into trouble with fluctuations, like the curvature has to be less than Hubble, and et cetera, et cetera. You get a Coleman de Lucia, you don't get a universe like ours. So I think that's where the paradox of perpetuum mobile comes from. The other issue I have, and again, I might be confused, but it seems that leads to a circular argument. Because you want to solve the time serial, but you are putting it by hand. The premise and the result are the same. I mean, you have to prepare that initial state for all those reasons, you know, M squared has to be less than Hubble, you have slow roll, blah, blah. So in that case, you have prepared such a special state, you have your era of time there. So the problem is not solved.
So all those are perfectly good points. Our philosophy here was that, you know, you have to start in some initial condition. And our philosophy here was exactly that, or at least analogous to what Alan was saying in his little classical mechanics example, which is that in the classical mechanical phase space where P and Q go from minus infinity to infinity, there's no normalizable probability distribution. It doesn't make sense to ask where should you probably start. But you can still argue that if you start anywhere, you have certain generic behavior toward the past and the future. So our hope was that we were claiming that we could find the most natural connected component of the universe in which to start, the highest entropy state that we could fit into a single region of space, but that the whole system, that was just a very small subsystem of a bigger system that was infinite dimensional in phase space, that supported an unbounded growth of entropy. So the whole point of our paper was to say the reason why entropy is increasing is because it can always increase, and we just find ourselves in a little tiny part of the universe. Obviously, that may or may not be right, but that was the set of assumptions that we tried to work under.
Sean, I want to make two points about your
right-hand... I think your microphone is off.
It seems to be
on. All right, well...
I want to make two points about your right-hand blackboard. I have to hold it closer, that's why. So the leftmost picture there, we have lots of well-defined theories of quantum gravity that really resemble the leftmost picture. And in none of those does any process that corresponds to either of the other two pictures occur whatsoever. Secondly, if you think about a generic initial state in a picture like the leftmost one, and stick it in instead on the past boundary of the rightmost one or the middle one, you find that you don't get the rightmost one or the middle one, but instead you get a big crunch. And so I've always considered this to be evidence that these different pictures, or at least the first one and the second two, correspond to completely different quantum theories, which don't really have anything to do with each other, and we don't really have a right to ask why are we here rather than why are we there any more than, you know, we would if we just believe that there are lots of different mathematical theories of the universe and we're not allowed to pick which one is better except by comparing them to data.
That's absolutely plausible. I'm not as convinced of its truth as you are. My prior is smaller. But I think that it's not, anyway, I'm not sufficiently convinced that I'm going to stop thinking about this possibility. One tiny little piece of justification for that is that I don't think that I should necessarily start in the past with anything resembling a generic state. This is an eternal universe evolving according to unitary laws of physics. I can start anywhere equally well and evolve to the past or the future. So if I wanted to find the state that got me here, I could just start here and evolve backward. I think that is okay. So I at least think it's still worth keeping in mind the possibility that all of these are amplitudes in the same underlying wave function, although it might not be.
Okay, last question, Doug.
Okay, I kind of like the idea that you're talking about how to sort of move back from the observer, right? So you want to go, given... G1, you go to G0, and you say, well, given G0, you naturally go to G1, and that's the interesting question. So at some level, why even worry about G1 in the first place? I mean, isn't you're saying G0 is what we should care about in the first place, or is there some subtlety here?
Yeah, okay, that's a very good question. The point is, I already admitted that if you start in gamma 0, you almost certainly end up in gamma 1. But I also tried to ask the question about gamma 1 itself by saying we should only ask conditional questions. Given x, what is the probability of y? So I think that I would be cheating if, having said that, I said, what is the probability of gamma 0? I think that it's much better defined to ask the question, given gamma 1, what is the probability of gamma 0?
Just because you like conditions, okay. Right.
Yes, that's one way of putting it, which I'm happy to admit.
Okay, urgent.
Yeah, sorry.
They're favoring people in the back. Look at that. That's terrible.
Yeah, we're we're at a higher level than you. I think your description is too crude of putting things into gamma 1 or gamma 0 and using gamma 1 to predict gamma 0 and so on. For example, you know, what I was thinking of in my talk is that you would adopt an assumption, a hypothesis, that on gamma 0, the assumption is you're in the vacuum. You're in the Bunch-Davies or adiabatic vacuum for the inhomogeneities. Okay? Whereas the...
assumption is false.
Well, that's what inflation assumes.
No, but gamma 0 is 1 second after
the
Big
Bang. Yeah, yeah, okay. So I'm taking it back to, you know, the beginning of inflation.
All right.
Anyway, so... But the point is, you don't have to lump everything together. You know, if you're doing conditional probabilities, you can make some assumptions about what's on gamma 1, e.g., where what the homogeneous mode is and so on, and some other assumptions on gamma 0. And that's another kind of conditional probability, and I think it's equally valid. And also on your gamma 1, I mean, there are many different observables on gamma 1. One might be all the data we have.
Yeah.
Another might be the expansion rate of the universe today.
Sure.
Just make that and then make some assumption nuclear synthesis happened or whatever. And you can put these together in any way you like. So I don't really see this distinction of, you know, treating given gamma 1, what was the likelihood of gamma 0. I think you should just look at all possible observations and, you know, your basic assumption, I think, as Andy has said many times, you want to put in as little of the data as possible and predict as much as possible with the simplest assumptions possible.
Yeah, so I guess I don't agree with that in the sense that I think that there is something special about what I'm calling gamma 1, namely it is the data we have. It's a little bit more than the data we have because we could just be, you know, it could be thermal equilibrium outside this room and we're all being fooled, but I'm being generous. And I think that... I think it's the most well-defined question we could ask is, given the data we have now, what was the rest of the universe like? I think that's a better... No, given the data we have now, make predictions. Go ahead, knock yourself out. What happens next? I predict the future. I think that's a fairly traditional thing to do, yes.
Okay.
I mean, I want to justify the past. I want to predict the future. The past I can't predict. I'm claiming in a model-independent way. I want to find a model that predicts that given my present, the past is what I thought it was. But I don't claim any credit for predicting it.
Okay, I'm going to cut it off. So before we thank Sean again... we're going to break until 20 after 12. We're going to come back for a panel discussion. And there's a rule. When you come back for the panel discussion, you have to sit before that second pillar because it's meant to be a panel discussion, meaning audience participation. So it's going to be easier to hear everyone, and we're not going to have to run all the way up there with the microphone if you come down here. So I will harass you if you sit up there. First, okay. Second, don't forget that after the panel discussion, there's a barbecue. The barbecue is going to take place in the bistro. And let's thank Sean again.